You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Pivot. My name is Arif Rafiq, and I'm your host. On June 18th, masked gunmen surrounded the vehicle of Hardeep Singh Nijjar in a parking lot outside a Sikh temple in British Columbia, Canada. He was struck by 34 bullets and killed instantaneously. Nijjar was an activist for the Khalistan movement, which seeks to create a separate homeland for the Sikhs out of parts of present-day India. As it turns out, the bloody murder of Nijjar was just one incident in what is now clearly a global assassination campaign being waged by the Indian government against its political foes abroad. This campaign has extended to at least three continents and is taking place on the territory of both India's rivals as well as friendly countries, including the United States. On Wednesday, the U.S. Department of Justice unsealed its indictment of an Indian man. It said it was directed by an Indian government agent to assassinate a Sikh American on U.S. soil. This killing spree is now forcing tough conversations between India and its Western suitors, who see it as a strategic counterweight to China. In this episode, we're going to take a deep look at India's global assassination campaign, its modes, methods, and motivations, and what it means for the future of India's partnership with the United States and the West. We'll be joined by Murtaza Hussain, an investigative journalist with The Intercept website. Murtaza has written numerous articles on India's global assassination campaign. Now, before I get to Murtaza, I just wanted to provide some context on the communities and groups targeted by Indian intelligence. Most of this episode will focus on the Sikh community. Their religion, Sikhism, was founded in the 15th century in the region of Punjab that is now split between India and Pakistan. The Sikh religion is distinct from Hinduism. It's expressly monotheistic and rejects the caste system. And Sikh concerns about maintaining their distinct religious and linguistic identities drove a push for autonomy or separation from India around the time of the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. Now, it's unclear as to whether the movement to create a separate Sikh homeland known as Khalistan ever gained the support of most Sikhs, but it did gain steam in the 1980s due to growing economic and political discontent and the charismatic leadership of Sant Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale. In 1984, things took a bloody turn when the Indian government raided the Golden Temple, the holiest site for Sikhs, where Bhindranwale was holed up along with hundreds of his supporters. In the raids, the Indian government forces killed hundreds of civilians, including many Sikh religious pilgrims. The raid shocked Sikhs around the world. Sikh soldiers in the Indian military mutinied, and in response, Prime Minister Indira Gandhi was assassinated 5 months later by her Sikh bodyguards. In response to the assassination, thousands of Sikhs were massacred by both Indira Gandhi's supporters and Hindu nationalist groups like the RSS, which is one of India's most powerful organizations today. The violence triggered a bloody insurgency by Khalistani militants, who now sought an independent country. Some Sikh militants engaged in acts of terrorism, including the 1985 bombing of an Air India flight that killed over 300 people. The Indian government waged an even more brutal counterinsurgency campaign, killing tens of thousands of Sikh civilians. The violence sent many Sikhs fleeing to countries like Canada and the United States, where Indian death squads are now targeting them. And now to our show. Murtaza, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this most recent reported assassination attempt. The allegations here are disconcerting in the sense that there was a real threat to human life here in the U.S., specifically in New York. But they're also amusing in how clumsy this attempt was. So what is the U.S. government alleging in this indictment that was filed on Wednesday?
So on Wednesday, the U.S. government unsealed an indictment showing that they'd arrested an individual working at the behest of the Indian government, and specifically in Indian intelligence agencies, to carry out an assassination of an individual in New York who was alleged to be involved or is involved in thick diaspora politics related to separatism and so forth, and other things that Indian government doesn't like. So effectively, this gentleman, Nikhil Gupta, who was arrested, according to the indictment, he had attempted to hire a hitman to assassinate this individual, Gurpatwant Singh Panung, an American citizen in New York. And he'd been doing surveillance on him. He'd been talking with his Indian government handlers, acting as an intermediary between someone he thought was a hitman in the U.S., but this ostensible hitman in reality was an undercover DEA agent. And everything that was happening in these conversations, he was recording it. He was using it to build the case that we now see against Mr. Gupta unveiled in this indictment. And effectively, as you said, there is a sort of a darkly comic aspect of it, because although this, you know, was a very serious attempt to engineer an assassination, a political assassination on U.S. soil, the sort of clumsy nature of the entire endeavor, you know, hiring someone you think is a hitman, they're actually a DEA agent, the way that this Mr. Gupta, who seems to be, from the indictment, a criminal in India involved in drug trafficking, arms trafficking, the way he actually tried to connect an Indian government official with this DEA agent, you know, having video calls with them, sort of investing a lot of faith in them, being a middleman to deliver cash to this individual who's working for the government the whole time, it shows the real limits of India's ability to carry out these killings, you know, at least in the West today. Because, you know, as much effort and resources that were invested in this case, from the very beginning, it seems that the DEA had the Indian government very, very much in their sight.
So this case is interesting in the sense that it provides a look at how law enforcement and intelligence agencies operate in kind of a global sense. So the Indian intelligence operative who is directing this criminal, Mr. Gupta, was using leverage over him, these criminal cases that were a sort of Damocles over his head in India. So in order to relieve him of those cases, presented this opportunity to, you know, serve as a hitman. And he subcontracted the job to a guy in the U.S. who doesn't appear to be of Indian origin, maybe from Latin America, because among the languages this Gupta guy spoke with him was Spanish. And that person was actually an asset of the Drug Enforcement Administration. So we have both the DEA and India's main external intelligence agency, known as the Research and Analysis Wing, or RAW, using criminals for their own respective operations to penetrate either criminal networks or networks that are seen as adversarial to their national interests. So that's an interesting subtext in terms of what's going on. But as you note, it's quite clumsy, because this was all being observed by the DEA. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, we often look at India's RAW, its main external intelligence agency, as kind of an equivalent of the CIA. But its staffers are largely fed, I think, from the Indian police services. So they're using these kind of local tactics at a transnational level. Sometimes it results in successful and brutal murders abroad. But in this instant, it was caught by U.S. authorities. Now, I want to sort of zoom out and look at how Indian intelligence operates at a global level. This unsuccessful assassination attempt was part of a broader plot, broader campaign to target dissidents and individuals who support movements that seek to separate from India. And we'll get into those movements and their motivations a bit later. But first, I want your sense of how this fits into the broader assassination campaign of India in terms of the modus operandi, the usage of these proxies.
Yeah, and you know, just very quickly, I think an interesting detail about this U.S. case, as opposed to other countries where India is carrying out these assassinations, is that if you take, for instance, what happened in Canada, there's a pretty considerable and well-known, underworld of Indian Canadians, a gang, organized crime, and so forth. So it seems like, from what we know about that case, India may have utilized those levers to help execute this assassination of Pardeep Singh Nijjar. Whereas in the United States, isn't really that footprint. There aren't really prominent Indian Canadian gangs in major cities and so forth. So they were kind of devoid of that means of operating, and they had to try to outsource it and said subcontract it to some Latin American guy who they thought could do this. And then it showed the limits of really that that capability. So, you know, in this indictment, it shows that they're trying to use organized crime groups in different countries where they have access to carry out these assassinations. And if you look at Indian state-connected influencers online, there's a former military official named Gaurav Arya, who's very prominent in Indian defense commentary. They openly make threat of using underworld figures in various countries, including the United States, carrying out assassination. So, you know, what we know and what we reported, The Intercept, is, you know, there's been this alleged killing in Canada, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, which people believe it's been said is utilized criminal networks, but also in Pakistan, which we reported a few weeks ago. The Pakistani government is very, very concerned about assassinations and terrorist attacks that have been carried out in the country in the past and are believed to be planned and attempting to be executed in the future against individuals whom the Indian government does not like in Pakistan, specifically Sikh separatists, Kashmiri separatists, and members of Islamist movements in Pakistan who have some hostile relationship with the Indian government. So, you know, in the last couple of years, we've seen a steady drumbeat of assassinations, very suspicious bombings and claimed by, you know, very shadowy organizations that, which do not have much footprint on, which are largely believed to be the work of Indian intelligence, either directly or operating as a sponsor or facilitator. Now, recently, we reported on a particular document from Pakistan's Intelligence Bureau, which is an intelligence agency in Pakistan under the ISI, it's a civilian agency, which is very, very concerned about a potential assassination that they feared was about to happen or feared was imminent against two Sikh individuals living in Pakistan, one in Lahore, one in Islamabad. And the individual in Lahore who was named is a guy named Lakhbir Singh Rode. And he is a longtime dissident in India who had left the country during the period of the insurgency in the 90s and has been based in Pakistan, believed to be based in Pakistan since then. And these documents said that, you know, like previous attempts we've seen against other Sikh, Kashmiri, and Islamist groups in the country, we believe that Mr. Rode is in very grave danger of assassination by RA, India's premier intelligence agency. We also believe has done surveillance around his house in recent weeks. This document is from a few months ago. So I interviewed his son around the time of reporting this, and he told me that basically it's very well known that his father lives in Pakistan under deep protection of the Pakistani intelligence agencies, fearing assassination from RA. And you know, because of an escalation of threat in the last year or so, he effectively doesn't go outside anymore. He doesn't go to the Gurdwara, the temple near his house, where an associate there was assassinated a few years ago. That's just deemed unsafe due to threats from Indian intelligence. And a couple of years ago, effectively, Indian intelligence had sent photos of father's house, where he's staying at the time, with car, to their Pakistani counterparts, effectively warning them and telling them to hand him over. A response to which the Pakistanis did not reply, to my understanding. They don't officially acknowledge the presence of these groups in their territory. But it's interesting because these documents we had, which reported on, they showed that the measures by which India carries out these killings in foreign countries, in Pakistan in this case, they're not generally done by RA agents themselves. They're contracted out to local criminal organizations or dissident groups, which is something consistent with what we know of this new indictment of this attempted killing in Canada, in the United States. It effectively, RA is at looking for people locally in these countries who can blend in, who are already involved in armed violence in some sense, and using them to carry out killings or assassination for their own political purpose. So in Pakistan this year, we've actually seen previously some arrests of individuals, of former army rangers. There's not much details in public about these cases, but when they were released, it's basically indicated that former Pakistani military officials, some level, were working for Indian intelligence to carry out assassinations in the country, similar to probably what we've seen carried out or attempted to be carried out in the Lakhbir Singh Rode's case, and the case of other Sikh and Islamist militants in Pakistan. And from what we can see also is that these killings have not stopped. They're still going on in Pakistan today. And while the government is cagey and not fully forthcoming details about these cases, it seems that Indian intelligence is still active inside Pakistan, targeting individuals that see political opponents.
So what we have is a pattern of Indian intelligence using local networks to target dissidents as well as people it views as militant threats in these countries. And that's sort of the unifying thread, whether it's in Pakistan or North America and Europe. And that gives it a kind of a plausible deniability. But as you'd said earlier, the context in the United States is a bit different because the Sikh diaspora doesn't have that level of, I guess, that kind of diversity in the sense that there are people who are involved in criminal networks in a very substantial form, as you may see, one may see in parts of Canada. So it's a much tougher environment for them to operate, but nonetheless, they've tried. And as your reporting and this indictment indicates, this is really a transnational campaign that extends to at least three continents. Now, you're Canadian, and so I just want you to unpack the dynamics that are taking place in Canada, because we see things are quite different there as compared to America. So, you know, why is the Indian government, you know, some could say it's quite concerned or paranoid about the Sikh movement, the Khalistan movement in Canada? Why is it so paranoid about this?
So, you know, as you mentioned, there was this brutal insurgency, a counterinsurgency in Punjab in the 80s and 90s, and that resulted in the creation of this giant Sikh diaspora in many places, but especially in Canada, and especially in major urban areas in Canada. There's a very, very large and very visible Sikh population. They've become more prominent in politics in recent years, especially at the national level. As you mentioned, one of the leaders of the major opposition party in Canada is Sikh. Even in the other parties, there's very, very strong Sikh representation in parliament at very high levels. And one thing that I observed just growing up, you know, around this community, is that a lot of these people have the Canadian diaspora have a very negative or uncomfortable relationship with the Indian government because of the circumstances in which they left the country, you know, under great duress, suffering atrocities themselves or their family members. Many of them were actively or passively supportive of the insurgency in Punjab because of a sense that their self-determination, they got the short end of the stick during partition, and the Indian government was not respecting their identity, attempting to forcibly assimilate them, which is a perception which continues to this day among many Sikhs, either in Canada or other countries, or including in India as well, too. So, you know, I remember growing up seeing a lot of my friends, I didn't understand the context at the time, but a lot of in their houses, they'd have a photos of Janail Singh Bhindranwale on the wall. He was the famous leader of that insurgency that the Indian government suppressed. So, you know, it's a very, very deep, deep-rooted conflict. And it seems that as much as the conflict in Punjab seems to have been pacified or suppressed inside India itself, inside the actual place of Punjab, in the diaspora, those sentiments are very, very much alive. And because of the fact that there are things that we take for granted in Western countries like freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, people who continue to foster this dream of an independent Sikh state are able to do so quite freely in diaspora. So one thing that seems very clear is that the Indian government is very suspicious of its diaspora, and particularly the Sikh diaspora. They're uncomfortable with many of the things people are saying and the organizing that's taking place. Even as much as they may feel in control in Punjab itself, the lack of control they have over the diaspora is a source of great angst for them. They seem also to be very uncomfortable with the rise of these Sikh politicians in Canada and elsewhere. So there's been escalating conflict in recent years, and we've seen some members of the Sikh diaspora organize referendums for independence or big protests against Indian government officials. Some of them are very provocative, and the rhetoric around them you can see is very provocative from an Indian perspective. And this has been a sore spot for the Indian government. But I think that everyone I know was very shocked when they saw this actual assassination of one of these diaspora activists, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, this year. And now the what appears to be attempted assassination of another diaspora activist in the United States, because that's a real escalation. Like, these groups are not involved in violence by any, there's no evidence produced they're involved in any form of violence and so forth. They're just, you know, involved in diaspora politics, involved in organizing, you know, what they see as a legitimate protest against the Indian government. But I think now, as the Indian government gained in confidence and international stature, they would like to extend the same rules that exist in India towards its global diaspora, including minority communities. So don't criticize us too aggressively. Don't play outside our rules, even if you live in New York or Toronto or Vancouver or London. But I think it's a very dire development. It shows that, you know, transnational repression is becoming a very, very salient subject. Normally we associate with China or Russia or authoritarian countries, but certainly with India as well.
Yeah, and that gets me to my next question. You know, we know why the Indian government doesn't like these individuals, and the individuals that have been targeted in North America in particular were involved in this referendum push for a separate Sikh state. And it's just a symbolic exercise, but yeah, I think it really challenges that sense of power and that belief that India is rising, that these individuals can, in free and open democratic societies, congregate and assemble and organize a referendum that India views challenges its own territorial integrity. And these individuals have the complete right to do that in a democratic society. And so we see other communities do the same thing or something similar. When we have Tibetans and Uyghurs and others who are repressed in their countries of origin and use the liberties of democratic societies to reestablish their own communities and also make political claims for back home. So this is not, so it's distinct in the sense that, you know, it relates to a South Asian community that is unique in many ways in terms of its political power in Canada. But in the end, this is how, you know, marginalized or oppressed communities behave, have been behaving for decades. And so this is the transnationality of marginalized groups in countries in different parts of the world. But, you know, when we look at the Khalistan or Sikh separatist movement and Kashmiri movement for independence, both at least as militant phenomenon in India and Indian controlled territory, have waned in their ability to exact violence in targeting Indian entities. So that makes this assassination campaign by India a bit odd, because it doesn't really correlate to a heightened security threat in India. And in fact, you know, the Pakistani state, which has backed these groups for quite some time, for decades, is stepping back from them. And the Pakistani military, which effectively rules Pakistan today, is very keen on normalizing relations with India. And so this is not a country, India is not acting as a country that is responding to imminent threats. And so that's why it makes all this a bit confusing in terms of seeking to explain why India is doing this. But I think when we look at political trends inside India, since 2014, and in the wake, in the lead up to Modi's election as prime minister in 2014, we saw a lot of myth building in terms of both Modi's image in India as well as those around him. So Modi was depicted as a man, in the words of his supporters, was a man with a 56-inch chest, meaning he had this broad, muscular chest and was willing to stand up to India's rivals and foes in its near periphery and far beyond. And the same myth-making was conducted in terms of his national security advisor, Ajit Doval, who operates these networks that are involved in this transnational killing campaign. And Doval, who is served in the Indian police forces, Indian police services for decades, was also with RAW for much of his career. And before he was appointed as national security advisor, a lot of Modi's supporters created this image that he was a kind of Indian James Bond who had operated inside Pakistan under deep cover and had penetrated these networks to some degree and had presented himself as someone who was a local Muslim and had gone under deep cover and disassembled in a way that was something that was like straight out of a movie or something like that. So they would call him, and they continue to call him, India's James Bond. So there is that myth-making element that is also a factor here in terms of how the Indian state sees itself and how it wants itself to be seen, and how India's Hindu nationalist government wants its supporters to view it. And, you know, this is all very much part of India's rise as an aspiring great power, but it's also a lot of this is taking place in the lead up to India's general elections next year. Indians will go to the polls again next year to choose their representatives in the lower assembly at the national level. Effectively means Modi's up for re-election. And in many ways, this is part of Modi's re-election campaign. And all politics, as Tip O'Neill said, is local. And this killing campaign that is taking place on at least three continents, I think in many ways is also about the domestic audience and the vote that is taking place next year. Now, you've spoken with many of these, you know, Sikh Americans and Sikhs that are based in Canada. Do you feel that, you know, the law enforcement in their respective countries, the FBI here and the CSIS in Canada, are really doing enough to protect these individuals who are Canadian citizens or American citizens?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. I think there's actually a point that I wanted to follow up with what you brought up as well, too. Because obviously, when, like I mentioned earlier, when the killing started to happen in Western countries, it was very surprising to a lot of people initially. Why take this very extreme step, seemingly, to carry out assassinations in a friendly country over an issue which seemed moribund for the most part inside India itself? I think that it was very shocking to the people in these communities at first, although many of them had warned that there are some of these threats on the horizon. But also, I think it's reflective of two things. First, like, as you alluded to, obviously, India is trying to project an image domestically and internationally of more muscular nationalism. And there are some in the Indian establishment or the public who feel that the country was too passive in the past, dealing with the national security or alleged or perceived national security threat. But also, I think it's also a bureaucratic or just a personnel issue, which is that many of the people who were involved in suppressing these insurgencies in Kashmir and Punjab earlier in their careers in India a few decades ago, those same people are now the higher up in RAW and other intelligence police. So they have, and from their perspective, they have grudges to settle with people who are involved in the Sikh separatist or Kashmiri separatist movements. And some of these killings in Pakistan and in other parts of the world, they have targeted people who are quite old, who are, you could say, retired militants in many sense. I think it's a personal grudges which are being settled between people who are very, very late in their lives in some cases, who still see that as an active issue, even if the world, including the region, has sort of moved past it. Now, to your point then about what's being done in Western countries to protect these individuals, a few months ago, after the killing of Hardeep Singh Nijjar, we reported, and I think we were the first to report this time, that the FBI had gone to Sikh Americans and told them that, you know, we have intelligence saying that your life also is an imminent threat right now. And the people I spoke to told me, and very consistently, that the FBI would not tell them from where this threat is coming, per se, but they just said that, you know, just be aware that there is a threat and, you know, you should operate with that in mind. Now, it's assumed usually when an intelligence agency comes and tells you that your life's in serious danger, that something, if they're not giving you an active plan right now to go undercover, the witness protection, not witness protection, but some sort of protection program in the country to deal with that, something on the back end presumably is being done. And they won't disclose that to you, but, you know, you have the hope or the assumption that there's something that's being done to protect you. So that's, at least in the U.S., people seem to have some confidence that was the case. Whether it's true or not, hard to say. But in Canada, where, you know, one of these killings really did take place, and they got away with it, at least the people who pulled the triggers were able to accomplish what they wanted to. I spoke to people before and after the killing, and I got some very disturbing sort of feedback. In the sense that I spoke to a number of people who were sort of close to Hardeep Singh Nijjar in the same circles. And they told me that when Canadian intelligence and law enforcement came to them and told them about this imminent threat, you know, they didn't really give them much support at all. They just said that, you know, your life's in imminent danger and, you know, you should have a plan to deal with that. And the plan, quote unquote, effectively, what they told them is just, you know, when you go outside, make sure to look around and just be aware of your surroundings. You should maybe have your cell phone charged when you go out. So if something happens, you'll be able to call or text someone for help. And, you know, they inquired in response that, well, you know, can we wear a bulletproof vest? Can we do something like that? And they told them, no, you're not allowed to do anything like that. Wearing a bulletproof vest in British Columbia is illegal because of some other pre-existing issues with organized crime. And you can't carry a gun, can't do anything like that. We just can't really give you any sort of support or advice beyond that. Just keep an eye out. And then the killing did take place at Party Thing in here. And then after that, they asked again, like, can you give us some more support? And they told them effectively, no. They said that we can't do anything other than asking you to just be aware of yourself. And, you know, can you imagine the level of, disconcerting or fear, which, can generate when you were told your life's in danger and you can't do anything about it. And also, we're not really going to help you explicitly either. It's really a disturbing reflection of the lack of seriousness with which law enforcement and intelligence agencies have taken the issue to date. I would hope, and again, we don't have full view into it, but I'd hope that in the U.S., there are broader steps being taken, especially now after one indictment has been laid against an individual working at the behest of Indian intelligence to protect U.S. citizens from these sort of incidents of transnational repression. But, you know, what's happened so far has been very, very bad. I'll give you one final example. There's a gentleman named Maninder Singh in Canada. He was a very close associate of Hardeep Singh Nijjar. They were friends. They knew each other for a long time. They're involved in the same religious circles in British Columbia. He told me that Canadian officials told him it's so dangerous for you that you can't even live with your children anymore. Your children are going to have to live in a separate house. Otherwise, it could be child endangerment because you're so at risk of being killed by Indian intelligence or some foreign force they didn't name, but presumably Indian intelligence, that you can't live with your kids. But also, you can't take any countermeasures. And we're not going to help you in any specific way to evade this threat beforehand. So it really doesn't really make a lot of sense. I think it's an area of policy which deserves a lot of scrutiny because on one hand, we have people who are so at risk of foreign intelligence that, you know, we're being told that you can't even live, citizens of Western countries who can't even live openly with their families. At the same time, there's not really an infrastructure to do anything to defend them or to stop this malign activity. And I think that going forward, that needs to be an area of focus for policymakers in the U.S. and other Five Eyes countries.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, if you look at the Indian press and even statements by Indian officials that are said on the record, they portray the Sikh diaspora as an extremist community that is indulged by Canadian authorities because of their political clout. But your account demonstrates that they're not doing enough to protect their own nationals. And many of these individuals who are, you know, clearly being targeted by India are effectively sitting ducks, and they lack the ability because of the constraints that are imposed by Canadian law and also the inaction by Canadian law enforcement. They lack the ability to really prevent their own deaths and to secure themselves. And when you look at this recent case that was unveiled by the Department of Justice, it doesn't appear that the FBI or U.S. law enforcement was actively monitoring Indian intelligence and their operations here in the U.S. This plot was discovered by the DEA because one of its own agents or one of its own assets involved in drug activity here in the U.S. was recruited by this proxy of Indian intelligence. And so then it seems like it went from the DEA to the Department of Justice over the course of time. So it doesn't really look like initially that the U.S. government was taking the threat of Indian intelligence to U.S. nationals very seriously. But we're starting to see some action. One, this indictment that was unveiled is a clear example of that. Indian news reporters, and these reports are unconfirmed, and the Indian press is quite unreliable, but they are reporting that senior officials with Indian intelligence were asked to leave the U.S. and U.K. and India has been barred from replacing its intelligence station chief in Washington. So there appears to be some behind-the-scenes actions that are taking place by the Biden administration, as well as other Western powers. But it's really unclear as to whether it'll be enough to dissuade India, because this is a country that has gone on a clear authoritarian and Hindu majoritarian trajectory since 2014. And there's really been no action by the United States to penalize actors there for even acts of massacres that have taken place when a U.S. president was visiting. President Trump visited India in 2020, and there was a literal pogrom that took place just miles away from him. And individuals affiliated with Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, they killed, you know, dozens of Muslims in New Delhi as part of this organized campaign to punish them for opposing a sectarian citizenship law or amendments to India's citizenship law. And this took place just miles away from a sitting president. And if this was another country that was, let's say, seen as less strategically important to the United States, you would have had half of Congress and the State Department and other entities all after the individuals that were involved in these massacres. But, you know, going back to our previous discussion, this killing campaign by India, this transnational killing campaign, is a byproduct of the indulgence of Western powers, because they see India as a vital ally or a vital partner in containing the preeminent threat to Western U.S. and Western interests over the course of the century, which is China. And you also raised a really interesting point about this kind of being the unfinished business of the wars and the conflicts of the 1980s and 1990s. So, you know, I had seen, you know, some of the profiles of the individuals that are alleged to have been targeted by India in Pakistan. And these guys were literally just, you know, old guys who are, you know, maybe, I don't know, working as grocers or and effectively were out of the game, you know, so to speak. And, you know, very much seems, as you had said, you know, this is a war between men who are in their 50s and 60s and whose youth was much long ago, and their active involvement, at least in terms of those forces that are oppositional to India, there's no real indication that many of them were actively involved in militancy in recent times. That's not the case for all of them, but it is the case for, I think, a substantial number of these individuals who were targeted in Pakistan. Now, final question, when we try to sort of frame this transnational assassination campaign by India, you know, many people compare Modi and the Indian government to Putin and Russia. Others, including in India, who directly or indirectly embrace the idea that India is responsible for all this, say this is straight out of the playbook of the West, that Israel and Mossad conduct these extrajudicial killings extraterritorially. They've been doing it for decades. Israel has been doing this since its foundation, targeting individuals who are affiliated with the Palestinian movement or, and before that, with the Nazis. And that the U.S. has been doing this throughout its history, including in the war on terror. So I'm wondering, how do you look at this? What's the best way to kind of frame this? Is this India trying to be like the West, or is it behaving more like Russia, or are these distinctions immaterial and this is really a function of power?
You know, it's really interesting because I've seen many people in Indian government-connected press make pretty much the point you've made. While not always acknowledging that they did it, they just effectively describe these killings as, you know, a sign of arriving on the global stage. And the calling card of a great power is that you have the ability to kill whomever you like anywhere in the world if you deem it consistent with your own privately determined national security priority. Now, certainly the U.S. has done that, as you said. Israel has done that as well, too. Russia has done it in the past. So, you know, it's difficult because there's some justice to that that claim, that because when Indian you know, people point out that, or Indian people in the Indian civil society and government point out that the U.S. has done things like this, yes, and Israel certainly carried out attacks like this, oftentimes against people who were not actually imminent threat to security targets, but were assassinated for political reasons. Now, I think that an interesting distinction here is that most of the time, these killings are carried out in countries, let's say by the U.S. or Israel, that are hostile in some sense to Israel or the U.S., like countries which are not their friends, usually. Israel did carry out assassinations in Europe many, many years ago, but stopped doing that because of antagonizing European countries. And certainly, U.S. targeted killing campaigns in countries during the war on terror led to a great backlash, or you could say great unpopularity to the U.S. as a result of this on a popular level. It didn't really endear the publics of these countries to the U.S. because, you know, oftentimes the collateral damage, you know, it's sort of an affront to sovereignty to carry out killings in other countries. No one likes to see that in their own country. What India did in this case is fascinating because on one hand, you know, Canada is a very friendly country to India. It's a major, major source of Indian immigration, or recipient of Indian immigration. You know, they're building ties with the U.S., U.K. and other Five Eyes countries. At the same time, they're carrying out offensive intelligence operations in those countries, which are the friends that they're trying to build a relationship with at the same time. And I think that suggests a great hubris. So, you know, Russia also does these operations in Europe, but it's because Russia is a hostile power. So if India is a friendly power, why would it be conducting hostile operations in the Western countries at the same time? I think this speaks to a very, very important thing that policymakers and the general public in the West should keep in mind, is that there are, you know, there could arguably are reasons to partner with India to contain China. Those are perfectly valid reasons, should be evaluated and discussed in mind. But at the same time, to put your guard down to such a degree and say that, well, India is simply another Five Eyes, you know, effectively another Five Eyes partner like New Zealand or Canada or Australia, I think it's very naive, because I think a lot of aspects of the Indian political system are not similar to the West. They're never going to be similar. And really, there's just an alignment of interests as opposed to values, as others have pointed out in recent months as well, too. And to operate in the assumption that India will be completely benign or friendly power towards the West, simply because there's an alignment over China, would be a grave mistake. And you're going to see more and more incidents like this, which were very shocking to many people in the West, which will take place if we do not take a very benign look towards India in that sense. So I think that, you know, India has aspects in its behavior like the U.S. or like, you could say, democratic countries in the West, but also many, many aspects in the system which are more similar to Russia or China and so forth. And India probably, you know, most likely, and I would say in my opinion, will never really be an ally of the West. It could very much be a partner of it. But there are very deep, deep abiding differences, which will manifest in ways which will continue to make Westerners uncomfortable in the years to come, if we don't take a properly calibrated approach to how to work towards India on issues where there are alignments. So, you know, I think these assassinations should be a wake-up call that, you know, India's perception of the West is very, very different from how some quarters of the West are viewing India at the moment, which I would say is through overly rose-tinted glasses.
Yeah, yeah, those are great points. I think when we look at when the West and the U.S. in particular looks at India and much of the world, it often does so in kind of a binary or bipolar lens. And so they put countries in two categories, those that are like us and those that are our allies versus those that are unlike us and our enemies. And India actually has these conflicting characteristics and is very, very heterodox in both a political sense and in a geopolitical sense. So it is, you know, the world's largest democracy, but that democracy, while a very historic achievement for a post-colonial state, is severely challenged. And many independent observers regard it as a kind of a hybrid regime that is not quite democratic and not quite authoritarian. There's a federalist system in India, so things get a bit complicated, but at the national level, India has engaged in great repressive activity towards political dissidents as well as minorities. And so its democracy and its institutions that were once seen as independent, like the Supreme Court and the media, are heavily suppressed and neutralized by the Indian state and the networks that are behind the ruling party, the BJP. And then when you look at a geopolitical sense, you know, it is really making the most of this multipolar era. And Americans, U.S. officials say, okay, India won't be an ally. It'll be a close partner because of this legacy of non-alignment, this unwillingness to attach itself to great powers. It wants to, you know, set its own, tread its own course, its own path. But then they fall back to language that is in which they essentially frame India as an ally. And when we look at this assassination campaign, as we've discussed, there are many drivers of it. But what is clear is that India is attempting to also establish the rules of the game and how it's able to operate, not just in its near periphery, but also in Western liberal democracies. And as we've discussed, you know, there is this kind of hypocritical distinction between what it does in the West and what it can do or is allowed to do in non-Western countries. So, you know, just don't create a mess in our backyard has been kind of the prevailing attitude towards India's aggressive behavior in terms of these extraterritorial actions. But now, in many ways, the chickens are coming home to roost, and India has killed and has planned to kill U.S. nationals and Western nationals. And so this is a killing campaign that is extended to three continents. And the West has a choice to make. You know, how does it shape the behavior of this rising power? It's unclear whether India will actually ever become a superpower, but it is a very pivotal state in terms of shaping the balance of power, both in Asia and the Indian Ocean region, and perhaps at a global level. And I think the lesson of this year, which has been a very pivotal year in terms of India's rise, it's been, you know, it's held the presidency of the G20, and then we've seen this killing campaign, and there's been a host of other actions in terms of that have accorded India a very important status at a global level, including the hosting of Modi by President Biden earlier this year at the White House. In this year, India has demonstrated that it seeks to operate by its own rules. And we have an administration and a kind of a liberal democratic policy establishment in Washington that continues to talk about a so-called rules-based order that is being challenged by Russia, challenged by China, but it's also being challenged by countries that are allies and partners of the West. And that includes India. So there's a lot of introspection that has to be done by actors in the West because they've, you know, created a monster in many respects that is operating in their own backyard, and they have to contend with the challenge of how to manage and mitigate India's malign activities on their own territories. So we can set other countries aside, countries like Pakistan, which don't really factor too much into the U.S. policy discourse these days, but you know they're literally doing this in the West. You know, I think Western countries have a keen interest in determining how India operates vis-a-vis U.S. nationals on U.S. soils, and the same goes for Canada and the U.K. So it's a definitive moment in terms of the transition, this transitional period in the global system, and the West has some tough choices to make, and it remains to be seen how it will proceed. Well, Murtaza, that was really, really informative. I hope to have you on again sometime soon.
Thanks, Arif. My pleasure.
And that's all for this episode. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice. And thank you for tuning in.